Good evening out there to all you Metzian folk. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Metzian Podcast. Almost had to be a quarter into the cookie jar for that one, calling it our old name. Anyway, thank you so much for tuning in this Monday evening, an off day for the New York Metzies, and we are thankful to get the bunch we have together tonight. So without further ado, let us bring on, before our featured guest, I just want to introduce one of my co-partners on this this podcast you listen to, and that is Brooklyn Trolley Blogger's own Mike LeColant. What's going on, Mike?
Hello, Sam. Good to be speaking Mets baseball with you again. Can't wait to speak with our guest. And, you know, there are times throughout the season that call for standalone celebrations. And I guess this series against the Rockies over the weekend is just that.
And that's the thing. We're starting to get into the thick of it. Finally, the Mets are starting to play a few more games than they had been at the beginning of the season. And without further ado, a man that needs no introduction, Faith and Fear in Flushing's Greg Prince. As always, welcome, Greg.
Good evening, fellas. Good to be here.
So let's get right into it. You know, before we get into a full season, even though it's only been about, I believe, 11 games, before we get into that full talk, let's talk about the Rockies series. What did you like? What did you not like, Greg?
I liked the two games they won, obviously. I like the fact that I'm getting a sense of who these Mets are, especially the two games they won, but I'm not just saying that for the results. They're not hitting yet the way we would like them to be hitting, but they are certainly pitching at the top end of their rotation. And they're playing good defense, and that is something we haven't really witnessed a whole lot for years. And Sunday in particular was, I thought, you know, the epitome of a team that knows how to play the field, that takes defense into account, that has, you know, capable players and confident players making the plays. So, you know, you look for differences, especially after, you know, a disappointing season or a couple of seasons. And, you know, I think that's one of those things Keith Hernandez or somebody about Oak would say, defense doesn't slump. That's why, you know, if the lineup is not hitting the way you'd want them to, you figure they will based on who they are. You don't expect a defensive slump. You don't expect, you know, somebody who can pick up ground balls all day to suddenly not pick them up the next day. So it looks like a good team playing. And, you know, it would be easy enough, I think, to cut them slack if they made a few misplays here and there because of how spotty their schedule has been. You know, 11 games in what is now, 2.5 weeks since the season, almost 3 weeks since the season allegedly started for the rest of baseball. So, you know, I wish they could have played Friday night in Colorado and Saturday and Sunday, just like I wish they hadn't been rained out so often previously. But, you know, those are the cards they're dealt. And, you know, they came out of it in good shape. You know, it's not a long signpost into the season, 11 games, but you'd rather be 7-4 than 4-7 or worse.
So, Greg, I'm going to go back to you, and I do think they are starting to tighten up their defense, but when you get a game like Saturday where the inning in question, and I forget exactly which inning it was, but there did seem to be a lot of fumbling going on. Do you think that they're just recognizing the need to tighten up? And you know, especially like you say, in Sunday's game, you really saw, you know, two of the off-season acquisitions coming together for the ultimate play of the game. And there is this different feeling around it, even though there has been some. I think there's been a little bit sometimes, just probably because they haven't been able to play as much. There has been a need to tighten up the defense, but we are starting to see that, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they're going to have days where, you know, a ball clanks off a glove. I mean, the DeGrom's one inning of, disturbing mortalness, let's say, those were three unearned runs. I thought that was a little questionable, the ball that McNeil did not handle. It was a tough call, but okay, I'm not unhappy that DeGrom's ERA was undisturbed. And, he gave up a home run later in that inning. But, there's just a certain confidence on the field, again, to the extent that I can infer it through the television, that I have those magic powers. You mentioned, the last play on Sunday, the offseason acquisitions. I mean, McCann is a real catcher. He's not a hitter who catches. He's a catcher who hits. And Lindor is a guy who we wouldn't know it yet, really, except for one at Saturday. But he's an all-around shortstop, including a hitting shortstop. And, I don't worry that, although I did look it up, I don't worry that he's hitting 189 at the moment. I'd worry if he wasn't making the plays, but he made not only, the tag to bring in McCann's bullet to second base to retire the last batter yesterday. He handled a bunch of line drives yesterday. No hassle, no problem. He made a really swift play on, I guess there was a bunt that he handled the throw for a second. I thought it clanked off his glove, but no, he got the call. He was ruled on the transfer when the ball got away. So, those to me are good signs. It doesn't feel lucky when somebody makes a good play. I mean, granted, there's always going to be an element of luck. Yesterday, Michael Conforto loses a fly ball in the sun, but he recovered and made a dive and he caught the ball. Was that luck? Probably a little, but he knows what he's doing out there. So, again, I think the larger point here is that it is a, you use the word tight. Tight can mean any number of things in baseball. Like, they're playing tight, meaning, they're too nervous for their own good, or, tightened up. They're not going to make silly errors or misplays. And I think that's the latter here. And just, to get back to, topic A here, Coors Field. It's amazing that they go, a mile above sea level, all of the reputation that we know of for Coors Field, and they win games 4-3 and 2-1. once in a while there'll be a fluke, that sort of game at Coors Field, but the Mets went into what's considered a hitter's park. They didn't hit all that much. They basically hit in one inning with timely hitting on Saturday in the opener of that doubleheader, and they came out of it with two wins. And really, considering they were going with a fifth starter and then the rest of the bullpen in the nightcap on Saturday, I think coming out of there with two wins is a great sign.
Mike, I don't think anybody right now cares about the fact that Francisco Lindor is hitting 189. I think that within the context of being enjoying the 7-4 record, even though they're about four games behind playing in terms of the rest of the division, even in first place, watching Francisco Lindor, it's so clear you have a professional on the ball field. And whether it's up at the plate, and I think that both the power and the batting average are going to come around, or in the field, you see a difference. Even though we gave up two great shortstop, potentially great shortstops in the deal, but that's what you have to do. And we'll see how their careers go. But looking at the overall Rockies series game, and you can use it within the context of Francisco Lindor, what did you like? What didn't you like? And also, Mr. $300 million, $341 million.
You know, you have to compartmentalize when it comes to money. Nobody's worth that much money. But Lindor is a professional, and he's a proven commodity. You know, he's performed before on the big stage. There's another person on this team, not so much. He still needs to prove himself. I'll not mention his name. But Lindor, he's a quality person, and he seems to be a natural-born leader. And he seems to have the best interest in the team in mind. He wants to get the most out of everybody, and he shows that. He shows that emotionally on the field, and it's a good thing. He's a positive person. He's a good person to have around. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, excuse me, insofar as the price we paid to acquire him. As you say, you have to do that. These are the steps you need to take. Sometimes you need to take bold steps in order to get what you want, and that would be a championship in our case. So I'm happy with what I see so far. You know, his offensive numbers will normalize. It's still a small sample size. We know baseball is a game of averages, and, you know, this will all iron itself out. I'm not concerned that last year, a compromised season, we only played 60 games, that, you know, he perhaps batted a career low 258, but that's okay. That's okay. He's 27. He's coming into his prime. So I'm very happy with his performance thus far and his effect on the team. So that pretty much sizes up my opinion about Lindor. I'm not worried about him.
So within the context of both the Rockies series and the season overall, let us talk starting pitching. And let us start at the top. Greg, so far, DeGrom has been as Cy Young arguably as ever. And then, you know, so far, small sample size, of course, but Stroman in his walk year, of course, is looking like he is in tune to try to earn that big contract.
You can't do better or ask for more than the Mets have gotten from, well, I don't think anybody could argue their top two starters. DeGrom does not surprise us. I worry almost a little about our collective micromanaging of his seasons, innings to innings, pitch to pitch, and by that I mean I think got into the habit in 2018 of rooting for him so hard to be recognized because he wasn't getting the wins that we were tracking his ERA on an almost minute-by-minute basis, certainly relative to what, you know, Scherzer, Nolan, whoever else was doing. And I think we've kind of kept up that sort of fan management of his season. And I think we're going to ascend last year being such a short season. You know, I think he had 11 starts, so there was just a sense of, my God, he can't give up a run, because if he gives up a run, then, you know, there goes the Cy Young. You know, I would hope that we all, to be fair, every question or every Zoom session after every start is, you know, hey, so Jacob, do you think you're going to win another Cy Young? Do you want to win a Cy Young? What about the Hall of Fame? You want to go to the Hall of Fame? And the answer is honestly, he doesn't make a big deal out of it. I think you just got to let the man pitch and enjoy the fruits of those labors, you know, seven innings at a time, however many innings he's left in for. But, you know, he was spectacular on Saturday to watch him strike out 9 in a row. And, you know, Tom Seavers held that record, 10 strikeouts in a row for 51 years. It's one of my earliest and fondest memories, the fact that he's had it. And there's only one pitcher in all of baseball who I would embrace tying or breaking that record. and it would be Jacob. And I felt like I was waiting for the elusive no hitter again, a little bit on Saturday, with some mixed emotions because I like the fact that it's Seaver's record, and it still is Seaver's record a couple of days later here. But DeGrom is capable of anything on any given day, and then I want to say knock wood, because I want to not put the Nahura on him, as they say. Stroman is just an incredible pitcher to watch. And I don't know that I've ever seen a Met pitcher just compete joyously and determinedly. I mean, they're all determined, but there's something about him that he's here, to put on a show and doesn't mind that we know it. And there's no stoicism to Marcus Stroman. There's a certain showmanship, but it's very serious. And I love that he knows who he is. He knows his stuff. The fact that he was, pitching in Denver, and they asked him, did you make a different plan because you're pitching, a mile high and in this traditional band box, or at least it plays like a band box. And he said, no, I'm an elite, I've got an elite sinker and I know to use that. And it was just, who says that? this is who he is. And it's a really fun contrast to what we usually get out of starting pitchers. You wouldn't want it if it was forced, and you wouldn't want somebody else to kind of pretend to be the way Stroman is. But I think with Stroman, it comes very much from a place of sincerity. And the fact that it's successful is what makes it, of course, such a joy. So if you have two starters who've made three starts apiece, putting aside the one that they suspended in the rain, and they both have ERAs under one, you can speculate and you can worry about jinxing and things, but you've got nothing to complain about, and this is fantastic.
Mike, to group with that, you have Taijuan Walker pitching to, I believe it's a 2.61 ERA. And at this point, obviously, he's the three starter, I would say. Let's continue to talk about the starting rotation. And unfortunately, Lucchese, in his first start, couldn't really necessarily continue that success.
Well, let's cut him a break. He was used in relief in his first appearance. And then, as you say, had an unsettling first appearance as a starter. But he's a lefty, and we got to fingers crossed that he works out. It's one of our off-season acquisitions. Taijuan Walker, we raved about his, his first performance. So far, so good. His Ks are up. He needs to get those walks down a little bit. But, Lucchese and Walker, these are the people who were asked to step in for Carrasco and Syndergaard. This is our depth. We're utilizing them as we speak. And they're somewhat effective. And that's a good thing because, as mentioned, Carrasco, we hope, is going to come back and perform. And sometime in the midsummer, Syndergaard will come back and perform and will be even deeper. So this is a good situation. Lucchese, he needs the innings. Walker, he needs the innings. We need these guys. They're going to be important. But right now, two appearances apiece, we need a larger sample size. But insofar as Jacob DeGrom, that game one of the doubleheader, I speak of command and control. Then there was the comeback, and then there's the closer. DeGrom, that was something special. As Greg says, he struck out 9 in a row. He was on the precipice of tying Tom Seaver's record with one more consecutive strikeout. Didn't work in, but it was still something special. And 8 of those strikeouts were of the swing and a miss variety. That's good stuff. And for the second consecutive start, he struck out 14 batters. And, you know, back in the day, those guys were doing that over nine innings pitch. We know that DeGrom is doing that over a reduced workload compared to, say, two generations ago. But what an outstanding performance, a special performance. And Stroman, you know, there's something to the art of pitching to contact. Something that, you know, analytic departments, they're not interested, it seems, in any notion like that. They want strikeouts. But there's something to inducing ground balls. There's something to inducing a weak fly. There's an art to situational pitching, just as there's an art to situational hitting. And we got a good demonstration by Stroman in just that. You know, he wasn't available to us last year. He opted out. So we're getting our first real glimpse of Stroman this season. And so far, so good. I became a big fan of his during the last World Baseball Classic. So, again, so far, so good. 7-4, first place. Woohoo! Pitching, we're utilizing our depth, and it's working out for us. So let's carry on.
Yes, let us carry on, and we are carrying on to Chicago. And unfortunately, she could not be on the podcast tonight, but I want to introduce the words of essay writer and magazine editor Megan Bungaroth, who I believe has been on this show to talk Cubs before. Out of Chicago. Here was her hot take. They're not hitting enough, and most of the starting pitchers are getting shellacked. But they did have an explosive offense showing in Game 2 against the Braves, which proves they can do it. Contreras is on fire at the plate. Javi Baez is performing. And Rizzo is a force as always. And Jock Peterson seems like he's still finding his footing on the team. Greg, here's where I will start with you. Aren't you happy we can go back to Wrigley this year?
Yes, I was happy we could go to Denver, snowfall notwithstanding. Happy to see the National League Central, the National League West. And, you know, it's one more step toward normality. It would be nice if there was a day game mixed in because it is Wrigley Field. Never quite understood the point of scheduling three night games in the middle of the week because then you're just like every other ballpark, except you have Ivy, but, you know, that's just the schedule, and hopefully, you know, again, no rain, no snow, so, you know, Chicago, here we come.
And, Mike, first, before I pass it over to you, just want to thank Megan for her words, and again, you can follow her on Twitter at Megan Bungaroth. Go ahead and give her a follow. Mike, Cubbies baseball, here we come.
Cubbies baseball, here we come. Well, you know, they've played two series each against the Pirates and the Milwaukee Brewers. And they came out of those series with a subpar record. And then they finally ventured out of the division. They played the Atlanta Braves and lost 2 out of 3. You know, there's still a lot of familiar names on that Cubs team. Rizzo, Bryant, Baez, but they're obviously in trouble. A rebuild may not be too far off. And from what I understand, the weather's supposed to be absolutely terrible in Chicago tomorrow and maybe even the day after. So good luck to us.
Oy, so you're saying we could see some more rainouts coming. That's not too nice, but I guess we'll see how the days go. You know, Greg, I'll segue this way to come back to the Mets, but a former Cub, Albert Almora, was used to perfection in that game I believe it was Saturday. Yeah, the Jacob DeGrom game, excuse me. You know, as I tweeted out, children, that is why you use a pinch run.
That was fantastic on Saturday, and I got a big kick out of hearing during Sunday's SNY telecast Steve Gelbs describe the preparation that went into using Almora of Louis Rojas letting him know that, you know, if specifically if McCann leads off, gets on first base, you're going in. And Almora goes in the back, goes down the tunnel, wherever they have their equipment in Coors Field. He rides the bike. He does some sprints. He gets himself ready. And the reason I got a kick out of hearing that was, almost a year ago during the baseball's unwanted timeout. I was fortunate enough to join in on a Q&A session with Joe McEwing, who has pinch run more than any other Met in the team history. And I asked specifically, like, how do you get ready for pinch running when you're not in the game and suddenly you're told go out there? And he said basically the same thing, that he'd run in between innings, go into the back, as he put it, dodging the rats at Shea Stadium. But, being mentally in the game and being physically out in the hinterlands of the stadium, so to speak. And, there's no underrating both the fact that McCann did lead off with a single and the fact that Almora was ready, that Almora was sent, that VR came through as he did, and that Almora makes this slide that was one of the more perfect slides you're ever going to see, with a real sense of exactly when to slide, where to grab the plate. Very close play. Yesterday we saw McNeil get thrown out of third base on, I thought it was a worthy try for a triple, but you see how close these things can be. So, it is good to see the manager, his head in the game, the bench coach, with his head in the game. And, I've done a lot of studying of pinch runners, use of them through the years, and it seems to kind of ebb and flow where managers aren't that impressed by the idea or managers understand their roster. And I think we're also lucky, by the way, we have 26-player roster these days, I guess 27 during doubleheaders, so you have a little more leeway for that sort of thing. So that was a good point. And Almora, since you mentioned him in the context of the Cubs, he is literally a championship player. I think, I could be wrong about this, I may be missing somebody, but I think he's the only one on the active roster who has a World Series ring. This is a little perhaps of a leading angle here, because Albert Almora has a World Series ring and Francisco Lindor doesn't. Well, still rather have Francisco Lindor, I think, but That said, I think they've built a valuable a number of cogs, if we don't mind referring to people as cogs. And, some days it's not going to matter. Some days, there won't be a leadoff single or there won't be a ball down the line from which to sprint from first base and things won't work out. We'll just, move on to the next inning, down a run or something. But when it works, it really makes you think that everybody knows what they're doing. Sort of, the analog for, what we were talking about on the field, where people know what they're doing and, how to handle balls hit to them and whatnot. So, if you can watch a Jacob deGrom start and find something besides Jacob deGrom to really enjoy, it's a great game.
Mike, it plays like that just remind me that maybe, people within this game still have their head in the game and what it means to play baseball. And that's one of the things that I just loved about the play.
Well, as Greg says, that's Luis Rojas' job, to be prepared. So well done by him. But if he gets thrown out at the plate, we're still raging at Gary DeSocina as we speak. That was a close play at the plate. He was safe. So, let's give a high five to the coach there. He saw our opportunity. He was aggressive. And it turned out we were safe at the plate, and it worked in our favor. But if he gets thrown out, we're raging at our third base coach right now. It's funny how that works out.
Well, you know, the way, I guess it was either the index finger or the pinky finger, but it was just everybody in the moment knew exactly what they were doing, and it was beautiful. You are listening to the Metsian podcast, and we are going to go to our featured guest, Faith and Fear in Flushing's Greg Prince right now. Before we get to the historical part of our podcast for the evening, Greg, you know the drill, shameless plug away, all the books, all the blogs, all the places.
The places at the moment is sitting in my recliner in my office, so I'm not still a few days from my second vaccine. So maybe a couple of weeks after that, go out and explore City Field and other destinations. The blog is faithandfearinflushing.com. Season's underway, so Jason Fry and I are writing about what we're talking about, writing about the games in Colorado, the games in Chicago, and all the games to come, and whatever occurs to us along the way. The books, if anybody's really interested, if you look up Greg W. Prince at Amazon, I think you'll find a few. Piazza, about Mike Piazza. Amazing Again, about the 2015 Mets. Faith and Fear in Flushing, a personal memoir. And The Happiest Recap, 62-73, about some of the defining wins in Mets history. And I appreciate you asking about that. Also, I had the opportunity certainly you've had him on, Brett Topol. He asked me to write the foreword for his upcoming book, the Mount Rushmore of Mets. Wrote a little something about one of Mike's favorite topics, Joan Payson. So I hope you guys get a chance to pick that up when it comes out. I think that's a month or so away. But that's Brett's great work, and I was happy to contribute. So thank you for the opportunity to shamelessly plug.
You are welcome, and thank you. I don't believe we've had him on, but we will have to certainly connect through you at some point. I appreciate it.
Oh, forgive my presumptions, but yes, Brett Topol is a fine writer and a fine guest, and I recommend him. But that's up to your many producers, Sam.
Our many producers. And one of them is here right now, and we're going to go to him first for the 1976 New York Mets. Mike, take it away.
I was in my glory, you know. I was 10 years old. I was having a blast. And you might call that the Mets' last hurrah before the dark years. But I was having a great time. And, you know, in my imagination, I still believe that had Dave Kingman not gotten hurt, he missed, I don't know, upwards of 30 games, 32, 33 games, that the Mets might have had a better shot of at least overtaking the Pirates, but a better shot at the Philadelphia Phillies, who won, I believe, 101 games that season. Mets finished 15 games out with an 86-76 record. And it was their second highest win total to date in their history. So, you know, I was having a good old time at Chase Stadium. You know, my baseball card collection was growing. I had a little stack of yearbooks by this point in my life. And I'm just a full-bore baseball fan, you know. And it's a great time. Dave Kingman was out from July 20th through August 26th. When he got injured, he fractured his thumb. The Mets were 3 games over 500 when he went down. And I believe the Mets they went something like 16-17 in his absence. But in September, they rolled to a 20-9 record. And that's why I always feel the way I do. It's my imagination. It's what I like to think about the 1976 season. It's one of my all-time favorite seasons. I'll pass it on. Great times.
Greg, I think you have to start with the pitching as you normally do when you're talking about the 70s Mets. We can certainly get into, you know, they probably were the best hitting Mets team up till that point. We can get into that in a second. You know, obviously the usuals, Tom Seaver, 2.59 ERA, 14 and 11, John Matlack, 17 and 10, 2.95, Jerry Kuzman, 21 and 10. 2.69 ERA. Mickey Lolick had a 3.22 ERA, even though he looked like he hit into some hard luck with an 8.13 ERA. But you know, this is back in the time when, you know, Tom Seaver was pushing 2.71 innings pitched, 2.62 for Matlack, 2.47 for Kuzman. Mickey Lolick got 1.92, and Craig Swan was 132 in the technical fifth starter at 3.54 ERA, but even Skip Lockwood was able to get 94 innings in here. Anyway, take it away, Greg. 1976 New York Mets, the bicentennial.
Yeah, the occasional pillbox hat sighting at Shea Stadium, a la what you may remember from the Pirates wearing. A lot of National League teams wore versions of that. The Mets wore it for a few special occasions. Putting aside their wardrobe choices. There is something very revealing in that rundown of statistics you just did. Tom Seaver had 14 wins. He was, again, you have to go back to 1976, put aside everything you know about the modern day game. He was better than a 14-win pitcher, but they didn't score for him. They somehow managed to find just enough runs to push Jerry Kuzman past 20 wins for the first time in his career, and that became, you know, that became the pennant race of September, that he got on a roll and challenged Randy Jones for the Cy Young. Jones had gotten off to a great start, and Kuzman came chasing after him, finished second for the Cy Young, and Matlack was Matlack. I mean, John Matlack was an all-star for a third year in a row, and, you know, this is, you know, He was, you know, on any other staff, probably, you know, your opening day pitcher any given year, the way he pitched for the Mets. Never pitched opening day for the Mets because, you know, they had Seaver. And he often pitched the second game of the year. But, you know, the larger point here is that this was the big three at their peak, all three of them pitching, despite the fact that Seaver's had better one-loss records in other years, all pitching near the peak of their powers, all with ERAs under three, all of them giving you a chance to win, which you would have a greater chance if you had some hitting. And, yes, you had Mickey Lolich, who was – I was introduced to a phrase that year by Bob Murphy. He was snake bit because they never scored for Mickey Lolich. The flip side of Mickey Lolich, the fourth starter, was that Mickey Lolich was here at all. And I don't want to go back to rants that we've had previously, but, you know, Mickey Lolich was the guy who was traded from Detroit for Rusty Staub. And I think that always colors my view of 76 a little. I was probably, you know, what Mike described his attitude toward the Mets and being a kid in 76, it's where I was in 75. And it felt a little off to me, despite the fact that they wound up with a better record. It felt a little off to me that year, the year I was 13, because they traded the guy with 105 RBIs for a pitcher who was, even though he was snake bit and he acquitted himself okay, was past his prime. So, you know, that always feels like, you know, 76 should have built on 75 as opposed to detracting. But it was a dynamite rotation. Skip Lockwood was used a lot. Because, you noticed the 94 innings. You know, that was the strength of the team. Dave Kingman, absolutely, as Mike said, was on his way to leading the world in home runs, leading the National League. It was lookout Hack Wilson that summer. Hack Wilson forever owned the National League record for most home runs in the season. He held it until Mark McGwire went to St. Louis. And Dave Kingman was on pace to break it. You never know if he hadn't broken his thumb. But, you know, that was, you know, mentioned Jerry Kuzman before. These were the two, you know, the highlights of 76, rooting for Kingman to win that home run title, to break that home run record, and rooting for Kuzman to win 20 games for the first time in his career. Two guys who'd been around, and, you know, you rooting for them at that point. I feel like I'm echoing a little bit when I said the last time I was on, and we were talking about 1974, and you just sort of, you know, you in 74, you know, there was just that core of players you were just used to, and it kind of comforted you. 76, you still have some of those guys. Obviously, you had Seaver, Matt Black, and Kuzma. I just mentioned Kingman. And, of course, you know, Cranepool, Harrelson, Meehan, the Grody. It did feel, though, like we were moving into the next era. We had no idea what it was going to hold. But, you know, one other name I'll throw out for now, and I'll let you, you know, go back to moderating the discussion, Sam. But, you know, September brought Lee Mazzilli up. And it was kind of, again, I don't think we necessarily thought Lee Mazzilli was going to be sort of the signature player of the next era of Mets baseball. But, you know, he was the first of the guys we would come to associate with the late 70s and very early 80s Mets. And without delving into the cliff that the team fell off of, you know, you have the sense, just, I had the sense, you know, something was up. I mean, starting with the trade of Rusty Staub, that this is not going to be this team forever. And, you know, I mentioned Jerry Grody, but Jerry Grody was giving way to John Stearns. You got to 1977 when Topps put out their baseball cards, and they didn't bother putting one. They took Jerry Grody's picture, and he was still on the Mets, but they didn't bother making a card for him. He said, well, you know, his day has passed because John Stearns is going to be the starting catcher. And there's, you know, little signs like that. Plus you had a new manager. You know, the year before they had fired Yogi Berra. They had used the interim Roy McMillan. And they decided that Joe Frazier had a lot of success at Tidewater and in the minor leagues, and we're going to promote this guy. And, you know, again, I keep coming back to the idea of the record. 86 and 76, as Mike said, second best, which was great, second best in 1969. Until 1984, it would remain the second best. It wasn't that great a team, but they got really hot late in the year, as Mike pointed out. And, you know, that was something to enjoy. It was long after the Phillies had gone away. The Phillies were a team that was on the come, as they used to say. Had been horrible forever. Suddenly, you know, they finished above 500 in 74. They made a run at the Pirates in 75 and 76. You know, Mike Schmidt and Larry Boa. I think Dave Cash was still there. And, you know, Dick Allen was there that year. Bob Boone, Gary Maddox, and, of course, Steve Carlton. You know, don't need to go down their roster. They just put it together. They ran away. The Mets actually spent some time in first place, I think April, maybe even early May. But the Phillies were a juggernaut, and we would have needed a few Dave Kingmans and a couple of Jerry Kuzmans, I think, to catch them. But, you know, you're again, looking at it from the perspective of guys like Mike and me who were kids then, it was fine. I would have liked them to have been a little better, but it was great. You know, this was what it was like to root for the Mets when you grew up in the first half of the 70s and in the mid-70s. You didn't necessarily expect to win the pennant every year, but you thought it was a legitimate possibility when the season started, and you weren't terrible. And finishing a little bit over 500, as we did every year except one, 74, after 69 and before 77, it was just, you know, it's what we expected. We expected great pitching. When we got Kingman, we expected at least some home runs. We expected pretty good defense from the likes of Meehan and Harrelson and Grody. And, you know, we do not expect to sink into the abyss. We were the Mets. We were New York's team. I don't need to veer off into what was going on the other side of town in 76. But, you know, in many ways, you know, it was the changing of the guard in the city, sadly. And it was, you know, the end of a pretty good era, very good era of Mets baseball that gave us, you know, a world championship and a pennant. You know, not too many players around from 69 by 76. A decent number from 73, still around 76, but that wasn't going to last. And, you know, yeah, Dave Kingman's thumb. Going back to that. So, yeah, the summer of the bicentennial, the red, white, and blue, the pillbox caps, and, you know, just good enough to keep you going. And as it turned out, I'll make this my last point on this round, you know, enough to keep you going, not just from year to year, but, you know, 1977, 78, 79, all those years come along, it's like, well, I'm not going anywhere because, you know, this is the team I rooted for is in my mind is the team that is capable and is, you know, going to enter the season with a chance to win something. And I think that that's the influence of all those years in the first two thirds of the 70s. I think it buttressed us, bolstered us, whatever the word would be, fortified us against the 7 years of famine to come. So, you know, it wasn't bad. I'll end it there.
You know, and 1978 started out like you might have in 1976, but unfortunately that is another topic for another day. Mike, to finish this out, basically I'm going to go back and forth between the two of you and just mention names I have in front of me here on the roster of the 1976 Mets. And Mike, I'm going to start with you. Bruce Boisclair.
Bruce Beauclair.
I missed the I.
One of the more unique batting stances of that day.
Okay. Ron Hodges, Greg.
Ron Hodges was in the midst of his 12-year extended residency on the bench in 1976. I seem to recall a couple of, at least one pinch home run, or maybe he was starting the second game of the doubleheader on Memorial Day in 76. A left-handed hitting catcher, which made him valuable, had sat out, or not didn't sit it out, but he was spent most of 75 at Tidewater because they were very excited about John Stearns. And John Stearns said, going to 76, look, I think I could benefit from a full year of AAA, which is an incredible thing for somebody who I think was 23 at the time, 24 maybe, to tell the organization. So they flipped him. And Hodges became the backup to stay. Stearns would come back later in the year, and again, he would have a nice long run. So, you know, that is the sort of, that's the sort of character you don't see anymore, the lifetime backup catcher on one team. You know, I could just throw in one thing about Bruce Beauclair. Visit Ultimate Mets database sometime, the fan memories. Bruce Beauclair is remarked upon all out of proportion to Bruce Beauclair's impact on the New York Mets. There is something about Bruce Beauclair who had a very good year pinch hitting, fourth outfielder duty, that sort of thing in 76. But every Mets fan of a certain age range, and which Mike and I are certainly in, just remembers Bruce Beauclair as sort of the, I won't say signature player, because, you know, you had Tom Seaver, but there was something about him that, you know, for four seasons made you gravitate and almost take comfort, to use that word again, in the fact that Bruce Beauclair and his Prince Valiant haircut and everything else is a part of who we are. So, you know, And yes, he had a difficult to pronounce name until you actually heard it a lot. So Bruce Beauclair, good on you.
Pepe Mengual, Mike.
Oh. You see, as Greg alludes to, Pepe Mengual, to me now, that, yes, indeed signifies that we're a team in transition. Out with the old, in with the new. You know, Grody is 33, Crample's 31, Meon's 32, Harrelson's 32. Jerry Kuzun is an elder statesman at 33. So Pepe Mengual signals, you know, changing or the start of the changing of the guard. A lot of younger players on this team, Mike Bale, Stearns, we noted. Pepe Mengual is one of them, along with Lee Mazzilli. The immortal Leo Foster. I don't think there's a Met fan who was around in those years who will forget Leo Foster, if not for just being Leo Foster. Not that he did anything incredible, but those two names, Pepe Mengual and Leo Foster, are the poster children for the transition that was about to come. I knew it was coming, but I was still having such a great time because, as Greg says, there was still a bunch of leftovers, some from 69, a couple of more from 73, and I was trying to embrace that and you know, absorb all that in. But you bring up Pepe Mengual, and I'll throw in Leo Foster as well. Those two guys, more than anybody else on this team, signaled that change was on the way.
Speaking of change on the way, Greg, Joe Torre.
Well, Joe Torre would be, you know, he had a pretty good year. He had 306 that year. If I can just chime in on Pepe Mengual. Pepe Mengual was a Met because the Mets decided to trade Wayne Garrett and Dale Unser. One
I didn't want to go there. I'm
so
depressed.
Wayne Garrett, stalwart, you know, forever the third baseman who they tried to replace and couldn't, finally did. And Dale Unser, who had a great year in 75 and not such a great year in 76. And for two guys from Montreal, one of whom was a bench guy named Jim Dwyer, who would go on to have some very good years in Baltimore. And the other was Pepe Mengual, who I recall, and I'm not looking up the splits or anything, I recall him killing us as an expo. Great speed, hit triples, that sort of thing. And it's like, I was not unexcited. I'm sorry to see the other guys go, but I was not unexcited to have Pepe Mengual. And that whole riff about, oh, they come to the Mets and they're no good anymore. Well, I won't say it began with Pepe Mengual, but it was sort of evidence of that. And, yeah, that didn't take. Joe Torre in 76 was at the end of the line just about, even though he had, like I said, a 306 average. It was kind of a comeback year from 75 where he was one of the guys who was brought in to replace Wayne Garrett. And, you know, Brooklyn boy, it was a big deal, but it was a homecoming. And it didn't really work out from a starting third baseman every day. And in fact, I think they stopped, for the most part, playing him at third base in 76 because he hadn't really played there in a few years with St. Louis. And he was, you know, first baseman pinch hitter and was doing well enough, I didn't know this until years later, to attract interest from the Yankees, who wanted to pick him up for their own pennant drive. And, you know, as I kind of hinted at earlier, the Yankees were having their renaissance season, and they thought it would be swell to have Joe Torre coming off the bench. And Joe Torre was enough of a veteran, I guess, that he had a say in where he landed, or at least could make his voice known, and had been told or that he was a candidate, maybe not in 76, but perhaps next year if things weren't working out with Frazier, to take over as manager, which is what he wanted to do, even though he was only 36 at the time, although he always looked older. And so I don't know if he exactly had the power to veto the trade because he was only on the Mets for a year at that point. And I think in those days you had to be 10-5, as they say, 10 years in the major leagues and 5 with the same team. But he asked not to be traded and stuck around with the Mets through, you know, a non-contending year, gave up a chance to, at the very least, go to the postseason and ultimately at the World Series in 76. And, you know, in a way, it paid off for him because he got to begin his managerial career at a pretty early age as a player manager for a few weeks or a few days, maybe it was, and, you know, started off on what became the Hall of Fame segment of his career. On the other hand, you know, he managed some of the worst and most depressing years at Shea Stadium. But, you know, Torrey was kind of in that Nicky Lolich realm of a veteran who had seen better days elsewhere but was making the most of it. Perhaps you guys have seen, or you can easily Google it, a photo of Lolich and Torrey on a motorcycle, you know, engaging the fans on, I don't know if it was picture day or something else. I don't know why they were on a motorcycle. I don't know whose motorcycle it was. I don't know if maybe it was Lolich's. I think now that I'm thinking about it, I think that was like maybe his thing. That you know, you could almost see the cartoon in the back of the baseball card. Mickey rides a motorcycle in the off season or whatever. But you know, as we're getting into it, this kind of melange of characters. You know, again, the core, the old guard, sprinkling of the new guard, sprinkling of the never will be. A few who would hang around, and just, you know, the veterans who, you know, to us, you know, to Mike and to me, seeing Joe Torre in a Mets uniform, seeing Mickey Walsh in a Mets uniform, it's not, I don't think it's stunning. You get the average fan from somewhere else, they probably react, Mickey Walsh was on the Mets, I had no idea. Maybe they would even react that way to Joe Torre. So, I think ultimately, Torrey as a Met was always kind of a better idea than reality, because, you know, they were always rumored to be going after Torrey. You know, any book you read about 69, they were making a deal to get Joe Torrey from Atlanta in spring training, and it fizzled out. He ended up going to St. Louis. So I don't think it was a huge part of his career, but from a playing perspective, but, you know, it was a pivotal moment for his career. He, you know, became the manager who went to the Hall of Fame.
One last point I'd like to make, Sam, is that now we're starting to see the ramifications of a mismanaged front office coming to bear. We know Gil Hodges passed away. Joan Payson passed away the year prior. And we know Bing Devine was in the organization as an executive. We know Whitey Herzog was in the organization in a scouting capacity. Whitey Herzog did not have good things to say about M. Donald Grant and his baseball acumen, but this team is in the firm control of M. Donald Grant, and you know, things are starting to deteriorate very rapidly. And I think those early 70s, you know, happenstance where Bing Devine left the organization and Whitey Herzog was upset that they hired Yogi Berra instead of him to be manager after Gil Hodges, you know, that's starting to come back and haunt the Mets and would for the next, you know, couple of years. But 76, I think, the fuse was lit from those early, perhaps early 70s oversights insofar as the front office. Greg, I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I think what we saw after 76, we understood it, but it was underway, was the lack of succession planning after Mrs. Payson died. That's, you know, her family was not prepared to really take charge in any meaningful way. And I don't know to what extent Mrs. Payson was involved the last couple of years of her life. But then Donald Grant was running the show. And we all know how that worked out. And, you know, Mrs. Payson, you know, I don't think was well the last couple of years of her life. You know, we saw her at the World Series in 73, and I'm not sure how much more she did. And let's, you know, let's face it, she trusted Grant for better or worse. And in a way, it almost didn't matter because the world in which M. Donald Grant was trusted to oversee a baseball franchise was one that could withstand M. Donald Grant. And the problem with specific to the year 1976 is that at the end of that season, the first free agent class was coming on the market. And boy, whenever we talk about prior to Steve Cohn, the Mets being a big market team that didn't operate like a big market team, I always think about what if Mrs. Payson had lived a couple of years longer and had been in good health a couple of years longer. The lady who wanted, who called Horace Stone in 1962 and said, how much for right. Willie Mays when he was at the height of his powers, what would have she done with free agency? And one can only dream, because then Donald Grant, whatever influence he might have had, I don't think would have stopped Mrs. Payson from going after, the cream of the crop when they were just simply a matter of writing a check. And then Donald Grant didn't believe in that, and then Donald Grant was, preserving an outmoded way of life in baseball. The reserve clause was over, and he refused to believe it. And this all leads us, as, the discussions from this era inevitably do, to June 15th, 1977. And, it wasn't too many months away from the 1976 baseball season. And that's where, it really begins to hurt. They had enough talent, certainly enough pitching to squeeze out that one more good year. They had those 86 wins, and it's, you're 13 years old or 10 years old, and, you're not looking at depth charts, you're not looking at organizational charts, you just figure, hey, everything's fine. But, yeah, it was rotting beneath the surface, and they were not, all due respect to Lee Mazzilli, an all-time favorite here, you were not promoting a lot of great talent from the minor leagues at that point. The great talent had come up in 69 and the early 70s. And, the name Craig Swan came up earlier. Well, an organization that had promoted and developed so many good to great young pitchers, starting pitchers, after Swan, that stopped, essentially. You had decent starters, decent starts here and there. The name Nino Espinoza was prominent in 76, and he did a nice job, but, he was never quite on that level, certainly not with the Mets. And, it was the worst, again, can't say enough, 86 and 76, Kingman 37 home runs, Kuzman 21 wins, all the things that we pointed out that were fun to be a kid for. But, Bad Moon Rising, as they say, and all the pieces were in place for the late 70s, and all the pieces were crumbling. So, and unfortunately, nobody, at least at that point, was nudging M. Donald Grant out of the picture. So, for the kids, it was fine. For going to Shea Stadium and then great place to go for on a Saturday afternoon and the brilliant sunshine and all of that. But if you were taking a longer look, and now that I'm thinking about it, I remember during that period of the summer Mike alluded to, where things were not going particularly well, there was like a five-part series in the Post that ran during the course of a week about how to save the Mets. Something dramatic like that. And this is before Rupert Murdoch owned them, so it was unusual for them to be this dramatic. But it was a whole thing about, well, the Mets are in trouble. What do they need to do? Should they be trading Tom Seaver because, he's all they have, that kind of thing. And I didn't really understand, they, at that moment, maybe they were a game below 500 or something. It's like, Well, why is Maury Allen, writing these things about how bad the Mets are? They're not that bad, but he knew more than I did. People who were close to the team understood that, this was not an organization on the rise, not from a personnel standpoint, not from, a management standpoint. And, in retrospect, 76 was last call. And our last gift we received, the 12th day of Christmas, perhaps, I don't know, but that I guess is for your 77th or 177th show, whatever the theme is. we'll let's save the spirit of 76 a long fly ball to left field, three long fly balls to left field. I believe it was June 4th of that year. Dave Kingman, three home runs. I think Seaver started an 11-0 whacking of the Dodgers. Nights like those, Skip Lockwood coming out of the pen, and you know, just
that was
so much good stuff. Let's cling to that.
That was a great night. I remember Kingman's three home runs at LA like yesterday. Sam, one more insight into that season. You know, another highlight by Tom Seaver. You know, he gets undercut by his 14 victories, but in that season, it was his ninth consecutive season of over 200 strikeouts, and that was a major milestone in his career. And we celebrated that in 76 as well.
And, Mike, one more homage to the pillbox top hat. Let's talk one more time about that hat. You know, did you like it? Do you know you're somebody who's a purist when it comes to the Mets uniform. Are you okay with it this year?
This year, I don't know, but in 1976 it was okay because it was all in the spirit of the bicentennial. So,
well,
you know,
this year meaning 1976, but of course we could literally have an entire 2-hour episode specifically about the 1976 New York Mets, but maybe we could do it decade to decade at some point. That would be a lot of fun.
There were some ideas going down
the road.
There was something about 76 and the bicentennial that, you know, you bought into things like that.
It was a great moment to be a kid in New York, because not only, you know, we're the Mets, still the Mets, as we've discussed, the bicentennial was in part a New York production. You had the tall ships, as they were known, in New York Harbor. I may be confusing matters here. I think the Queen might have come to New York to witness that with then President Ford. And you had the Democratic National Convention came to New York that same month. I think it was July 12th to 15th, the one that nominated Jimmy Carter and Fritz Mondale, who incidentally, while we've been on the phone, I just learned of Fritz Mondale's passing.
Yeah.
Not to go off on a total tangent here, but just so you know that while I was talking about Kuzman being the runner-up to Randy Jones for the Cy Young, it's something I noticed years ago. They announced, or the Cy Young that year on the same day as Election Day, when Walter Mondale was elected vice president with Carter, and it struck me they were both from Minnesota. They were both well liked in their field, well accomplished, and they got, you know, there was, you know, Kuzman was always vice president of the pitching staff, it seemed to me, behind President Seaver, if you will. So funny how that works. But it was, you know, again, the summer of 76 was an interesting time to be in New York, to kind of soak it in a little bit from afar. I lived on Long Island, so I wasn't exactly running around Manhattan or anything, but very, very fond memories, Mets, you know, part of that from that summer. And, you know, part of growing up, and whatever numerical theme brought us here, guys, I appreciate 1976 being part of the show tonight.
Well, you know, in our chronology of these seasons, when talking about the city, 1977 coming up, it's going to be quite the conversation talking about not only the Mets and the major transition in a negative way that was that season, but also what was going on in New York City at the time. You know, there's darkness at some point. There is a serial killer out there. There's so many different things to talk about when it comes to the summer of 77. And I hope you will join us on that episode whenever episode 77 comes about. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and we are so thankful you do, and we are segueing over to our final word, and I will first start again with our featured guest, Greg. Thank you so much, Greg Prince of Faith and Fear in Flushing. Thank you so much for joining us on the Metsian Podcast this evening.
My pleasure.
And what would be your final
Am I final wording here?
Yeah,
well,
final word away.
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess in the spirit of bad management and darker days and blackouts, au revoir, Bernie Madoff, from this mortal coil. You usually when somebody of significance in the Mets world passes, a person might want to come up with something nice to say about him, but I think the nicest thing one can say about Bernie Madoff is that, certainly from a Mets standpoint, the Mets have moved on from the influence of Madoff and of Wilpon and, how things were run. So, I don't want to wish people ill. But glad we're out of that era. There are certain eras in Mets baseball. I will imagine that somewhere, whatever the future platform is, whether it's podcasting or something else down the line, 40-odd years from now, somebody's going to come on a show like this and remember so fondly when they were a kid in 2011, 2013, being a Mets fan, even though, hey, they weren't that good, but we had this or that. And, it will totally ring true for those kids. But, just like we know what and Donald Grant was destroying the Mets. You have to have that childlike enthusiasm and maintain it for many decades to get through eras like the M. Donald Grant ruining the Mets era and the influence of Madoff and on the Wilpons. So don't mean to be a downer here. So let's also say, it's a better day now. I'm giving you more than one word, and I apologize, but it occurs to me that as I was talking to you at the beginning of the show about, what happened in Colorado, what might happen in Chicago this week, my default emotion is optimism. And I don't know that other than very briefly during good spurts since I've been talking to you on a Metsian podcast and its predecessor podcast, my default emotion has always been, what's going to go wrong? And I'm not feeling that now. So, let's call it optimism. Let's make that the final word of the night. I know it's only 11 games, but I'm looking forward to the 12th game. I'm looking forward to the rest of the week and the month and the rest of the season more so than just because it's baseball. So thank you for the chance to express that. Thank you for the chance to take up your time with more final words than you asked for.
Greg, I think you hit the nail on the head. There is a sense of optimism, you can't completely shake the Metsian way off right away as we have known it to be under the Wilpons, but that doesn't mean that things aren't headed in the right direction. So I appreciate that and thank you again. And I will pass it over to Mike. Mike LeColant, the Brooklyn Trolley blogger, please shamelessly plug away. Tell everybody where they can find you as well as your final word.
On Twitter, you can get me, what is my handle? What is my handle? I don't even know. Hold
I think
on,
you
let
got
me check it.
BTB, BTB underscore.
If I don't use it, I don't know it. Here we go. BTB underscore Mike II or Roman numeral 2, as I like to think. That's Twitter. On the net, BrooklynTrolleyBlogger.blogspot.com, where I root for my teams. I delve into history and just celebrate my life here in Brooklyn. It's where I have fun, so check it out. Otherwise, last word, let's go Mets, and 1976 forever. But let me go off the reservation here for a second. You know how news stories come and go. They spend 3 minutes and they never talk about it again. Well, one of our own, Ed Cranepool, we know a couple of years ago, he was enduring health problems, and he got his transplant, and I hope everything's well for him today. Because in 1976, he hit a home run against the Giants. It was a weeknight game that won it for us. And, you know, as a 10-year-old, as far as I'm concerned, that ball still hasn't come down. It was just a thrilling night, one singular game, a weeknight, Mets against the Giants, and such a thrill. Eddie Cranepool hit that home run. So like I said, news does a bad job of following up on any story. They give you 3 minutes, and then you never hear from it again. Well, as Met fans, I hope Eddie Cranepool's doing good, because we knew he had encountered some health problems. No one's followed up on that story. So my well wishes on behalf of the Smetsian podcast and all Met fans, hope Ed Cranepool's doing well. That was a little random of me, but you know what? 1976 triggered it.
Well, you make a good point. We do hope that Ed Cranepool is doing well, and let us finish with Ed Cranepool. He had 455 plate appearances that year, 415 at-bats. He had 10 home runs, 49 RBIs, batted a .292 average, and .344 on-base percentage. This was a pretty solid year for the 31-year-old who was in 123 games that year. So thank you, Mike, for that, and we appreciate everything. I once did talk to Ed Cranepool, and he was as cordial as ever and was, you know, ready to talk Mets baseball and the Wilpons with me. So that was pretty that was pretty fun one way or another. So thank you all for listening to the Metsian Podcast. Thanks again to Greg Prince of Faith and Fear in Flushing. Thank you to Mike LaColant, BrooklynTrolleyBlogger.blogspot.com. And we will catch you next time. Thanks again, all. Take care. Let's go, Mets.
Good night, all. Good night, Greg. Good night, Mets.